From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After years, decades of bitter enmity with phrases like Axis of Evil and Death to America as pretty accurate reflections of official policy in Washington and Tehran, a major breakthrough in talks with Iran this weekend, an interim nuclear deal, and a huge range of reaction. Here was President Obama praising the diplomatic spadework.
Today, that diplomacy opened up a new path toward a world that is more secure, a future in which we can verify that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful and that it cannot build a nuclear weapon.
In Tehran, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said the deal amounts to a recognition of Iran's right to nuclear technology, enrichment ostensibly for peaceful purposes.
The world powers have recognized Iran's nuclear rights.
And from Israel and tough critics beyond, deep, deep skepticism, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
What was concluded in Geneva last night is not a historic agreement. It's a historic mistake.
There are critics aplenty, supporters who say this could be a Nixon goes to China game changer for the Middle East, news of a big back channel that helped get it done, and lots of questions. This hour on Point, an opening nuclear deal with Iran. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see promise, peril, a breakthrough, a mistake? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post and contributor to the paper's postpartisan blog. David Ignatius, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
What's just happened here, David?
What's just happened is that the U.S., aided, supported by its negotiating partners from the so-called P5 plus one group, has reached an interim deal for 6 months to negotiate a comprehensive deal to make sure that the Iranian nuclear program remains peaceful and civilian, not heading toward a nuclear weapon. The essence of the deal that was reached is that for this six-month period, Iran will freeze its enrichment and other activities that would be part of a nuclear weapons program and will reverse modestly some activities in return for release of what is being estimated at about $7 billion in the Iranian assets that have been collected under the international sanctions program. So it is a first step in what has been just a continuing, ever-expanding Iranian nuclear program. The test of the deal, in a sense, will be whether 6 months from now the U.S. and Iran are headed toward a comprehensive agreement or whether there's so many difficulties in making the interim agreement work that they're, in fact, heading toward something that would be dangerous, which would again raise the issue whether military force will be necessary to deal with an Iranian program where diplomacy, which is succeeded last weekend, is not going the rest of the way. But I think most people looking at this would say there's more in the deal than observers expected the U.S. could get from Iran. There's probably stronger language from Iran's standpoint on the right to enrich, certainly than Israel wanted, and that some in the U.S. were predicting.
Why such an epic emotional range of reaction to this? This isn't just quibbling over it by any means. This is a stark, historic mistake versus, you know, potential for historic breakthrough range of reaction here. Why so wide, David?
I think there are several reasons. One is that we're just now beginning to understand that this deal was essentially done in secret bilaterally between the United States and Iran and presented to our allies, including Israel, largely as a fait accompli. Israel was briefed at a certain point, but the bristling from our allies, such as France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius in Geneva 2 weeks ago, got very angry, stormed out of a meeting, made comments. In part, he was upset that he was being presented with a text that it had been pre-negotiated. So that's the first thing. This was done by the U.S. and Iran. Others felt left out. I'm a little bit surprised that Prime Minister Netanyahu has backed himself into such a corner with such a completely unyielding position. Diplomacy usually is the art of leaving yourself some maneuvering room. I think the Israelis are genuinely concerned, and I can understand why, that the U.S. in the preamble for this agreement, has accepted that Iran will have a right to a full nuclear program under a comprehensive agreement, and then it's specified that that would include a mutually defined enrichment program. In other words, we have prospectively granted the thing that Israel fears most, which is that Iran can enrich, Iran can come right up to the edge of having a bomb. You never again will have UN Security Council resolutions demanding that Iran stop enrichment, calling its enrichment activities illegal. Basically, that cat is now out of the bag, and I think that's at the heart of Israeli opposition to the deal.
Here's John Kerry speaking to just that point. This was on Face the Nation, CBS yesterday, saying this is based on hard-nosed negotiating, not wishful thinking, and on intrusive investigation as it goes along.
It's based on intrusiveness into their program that we don't have today. It's based on the destruction of their uranium. It's based on a limitation on their stock. So there's nothing built on trust. We're not sitting here pretending that Iran is going to suddenly turn over a new leaf. We have to prove it. Mm-hmm. And our structure in this agreement, I believe, will adequately prove it.
What's the basis of the American optimism or willingness to go more deeply down this path, David? I mean, Israel doesn't want to see a nuclear weapon in Iran. Surely Washington does not either. So?
The essence, Tom, of any deal that will work is that it can be sold to both publics. And that's the case with this deal. Iran can go back, as President Rouhani is doing, and saying the West has finally granted that we have a right to enrich, and prospectively we have granted that.
I think though Kerry's saying explicitly they have not.
Well, I can read you the language in the agreement.
Yeah, the mutual.
It says that as part of the comprehensive solution, it would, and I'm quoting here, would enable Iran to fully enjoy its rights to nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. And then it goes on to specify that this, quote, would involve a mutually defined uranium enrichment program. So the language is there.
Not a right, but a fact.
Well, you could, if I mean, depending it's how you diplomacy. Interpret. It's yeah. diplomacy. Yeah. If you're John Kerry, you can say, well, we haven't really granted the right. If you're President Rouhani, you can say, yes, it is. It says mm-hmm. the word right is
there.
Right in the agreement. Mm-hmm. So that's the language on enrichment. It is true that we have gotten a more intrusive program to see what the Iranians are doing than we ever have had. And that's really important just in terms of monitoring compliance and also understanding the guts of the program. So we'll have daily inspections at the once covert facilities at Natanz and Fordo near Qom. There will be dilution or conversion of the most threatening material enriched to 20%. Mm-hmm. Bomb-making level is usually 90%, but 20% is scary, but that will be converted or diluted. So that's important. The cascades of centrifuges that would take the existing stockpile of 5% enriched uranium up to the 20% and above level will be in part disconnected. Centrifuges that Iran would be adding that are the most modern variety and could quickly increase the level of enrichment will not be installed, and their non-installation will be verified by these daily inspections. So there's really quite a lot in terms of limits on the program and also ability to monitor Iranian compliance. So again, I'd come back to the point, the deal that would work by definition would be one that each side could take home and say, look, we got it. And the Iranians are saying that, and I've tried to explain why. And we can say the same thing in terms of limits on the program, to some extent reversal of aspects of the program. This is a six-month deal, so all these issues could come back with even greater intensity, including the risk of military action 6 months from now if people don't follow on what was accomplished in Geneva.
And there's already a fairly rugged response in no small parts of the American political spectrum. What about the political—I mean, there's the nuclear capacity issue, but there's also the whole issue of this kind of Nixon goes to China interpretation here, that what's unfolding here is a major realignment. The United States perhaps repairing, after 3+ decades of deep estrangement, repairing a relationship with Iran that would change the diplomatic complexion of the whole region. What about that, the view of this, David?
Tom, I think that's the part that we really don't know yet. I would say, as a longtime observer of the Middle East, that it would be very much in the interest of the United States to draw Iran into some kind of framework for regional security in which Iran agrees to give up or halt its progress toward a nuclear weapon and agrees to other limits on its destabilizing behavior. Iran treats the rest of the region often as an opportunity for covert action in Syria, in Bahrain, in Lebanon. So a turn in Iranian behavior, as Henry Kissinger once said, where Iran becomes a nation, not a cause. That's the prospect for greater stability that we should all have in mind. And it's really too early now to say whether that turn is beginning. President Rouhani has permission from his boss, the supreme leader, to negotiate a nuclear deal. We now know that. We've seen it. He does not have permission. He told me as much when I met with him in New York in September in a one-on-one interview. He told me that he did not have the files for regional action or for some broader normalization of relations with the U.S. Those issues lie ahead.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big deal with Iran, an interim deal over sanctions and its nuclear program, the controversy over this agreement, the possibilities here, the road ahead. Plenty of pushback in the U.S., applause as well. Pushback here. Yesterday on Fox News Sunday, Senator Bob Corker, Republican, Tennessee, ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, criticized the deal. And the proof for him is that Iranians, he said, are delighted.
The reaction in Iran right now, I mean, they're spiking the football in the end zone saying that, look, we've consolidated our gains, we've relieved sanctions, we're going to have the right to enrich. So I think there are going to be some people that want to impose additional sanctions. That's another effort that we may well take part in.
Not all Democrats supported by any means. On Sunday in a press conference, New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, often an ally of the president, worried that the P5 plus one negotiators gave Iran more than they got.
I'm disappointed by the terms of the agreement between Iran and the P5 plus one nations because it does not seem proportional. Iran simply freezes its nuclear capabilities while we reduce the sanctions. That is not a proportionate agreement.
But President Obama, speaking to the nation just as soon as word of the agreement came out, this was Saturday night, said we've got to try this path. We have to test it.
Ultimately, only diplomacy can bring about a durable solution to the challenge posed by Iran's nuclear program. As president and commander-in-chief, I will do what is necessary to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. But I have a profound responsibility to try to resolve our differences peacefully rather than rush towards conflict. Today we have a real opportunity to achieve a comprehensive peaceful settlement, and I believe we must test it.
So let's test it, says the president. David Ignatius, please stand by in Washington. With us from Syracuse, New York today, Mirzad Borjerdi. He is director of the Middle East Studies Program at Syracuse University, president of the International Society of Iranian Studies. Mirzad Borjerdi, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Tel Aviv in Israel, Emily Landau is here, senior research fellow at Israel's Institute for National Security Studies in Herzliya, where she's also director of the Arms Control and Regional Security Project. Emily Landau in Tel Aviv, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Emily, can you share with us something of the range of responses in Israel to the news of this agreement? If there is a range, what does it look like? We've heard from the prime minister. Is there unanimity? Are there different perspectives? What do you see, Emily?
I think there's a lot of agreement with the prime minister's stance. But I think it's important to understand that this issue really shouldn't be framed as a political issue, the right in Israel, the left in Israel. Netanyahu and others are focusing on technical aspects of an interim nuclear deal. And I think this is really the issue that that we should be focused on and that we should be assessing. And not only assessing the interim deal, but assessing what is likely to happen over the next 6 months after this interim deal has been reached. I did want to say something about, you know, the interim deal. It was said about these new advanced centrifuges. It's important to take into account this is actually one of the problematic or potentially problematic aspects even of the interim deal. These new generation advanced centrifuges that can enrich uranium 4 to 5 times faster than the centrifuges that Iran has been using are a major source of concern. We know from the IAEA report that about 1,000 of these centrifuges have already been installed in Natanz. Now, the interim agreement says that they can't operate these centrifuges. However, there's nothing about whether they can test these centrifuges. And the testing stage is exactly the stage that Iran needs to complete at this point. So this is an issue, I think, that remained fuzzy in the deal and that Iran could easily interpret as allowing it to continue testing, which would be a problem. And this brings me to, you know, the whole issue of interpretation. The deal that has been reached between the P5 plus one and Iran, we've seen what the United States has made public, the points of the deal, and we've seen what the Iranian Foreign Ministry has issued as the points that are included in this deal. And curiously enough, these two documents are not identical. That's a major issue, and it opens up a tremendous amount of room for different interpretations. And I think a major fear here in Israel is that what we're going to see over the next months is continued arguing over who agreed to what, who's upholding what. We saw this, by the way, 10 years ago when there were also two short-lived agreements for Iran to suspend uranium conversion activities. And what we saw happening is that Iran just continued to argue about everything that had been agreed, at least as far as the Europeans were concerned. I also expect that Iran will continue to press for additional lifting of sanctions. I don't think that we should expect that Iran will just sit tight with the sanctions that have been lifted and not demand more in 2 months' time, in 3 months' time. Already in Geneva on the second day, the Iranians were making additional demands to lift sanctions with regard to oil sales and with regard to their banking system. And I think this was just an indication of what probably will come in the coming months. So I think that the international community is going to embark on a very, very rocky road in the coming months.
Skepticism on a number of fronts right there. Mirzad Borogherdi, listening there in Syracuse, New York. What do you make overall of this deal?
I have a quite opposite viewpoint. I think what transpired in Geneva is of historical significance. Even though this is an interim agreement, it hopefully spells out the possibility of putting behind us 3 decades of hostility between the United States and one of the more important countries in the region. Of the over 190 countries in the world, so far only 3 have objected to this deal, and those are Israel, Saudis, and the conservative government in Canada. Everybody else seems to be happy about what's going on, and I don't think we need, in this country, we need to, subcontract foreign policy to the Israelis, the Saudis, or others.
What about the response that we heard there from Bob Corker saying Iranians are spiking the football in the end zone, they've really scored here, and there's delight in Iran? He's suggesting his delight because they feel like they've sort of won in these negotiations and they're headed toward a goal of nuclear arms.
No, look, hardliners on both sides are arguing that the deal gave up too much and got too little. We are seeing it in the U.S. We are seeing it in Iran. Already, the conservative newspapers in Iran are going on a rampage criticizing, Rouhani for the deal. The fact of the matter is that Iran did make certain important compromises, right? Diluting 200 kilograms of 20% uranium, not adding to its stockpile of 3.5% uranium, not installing new centrifuges, and so forth and so on. And what did it get in return? Basically, the Obama administration rewarded Iran with their giving them part of their own frozen money. So to argue that Iran got the better deal, I think is really quite something. And as was pointed out, we need to understand that. When it comes to the critics, whether it's the Saudis or the Israelis, they are opposed to the even establishment of ties between Iran and the U.S., let alone having a nuclear deal that basically is going to roll back but not zero out Iran's overall enrichment capacity. And mm-hmm. I think we have to be realistic about where Iran has come over the last two decades. After all, this is a country that has invested heavily. It has the human capital. They have created an indigenous, nuclear program. And to expect that the Iranians are going to put everything on a silver platter and, hand it out to the West and say, sorry, we made a mistake, is quite unrealistic. I mean, Iran is not Libya, right? And they do not make that type of a decision. So I think the Obama administration is quite correct in thinking that the clock is ticking. He does not want to see Iran become a nuclear power on his watch. And what he managed to get out of this agreement is to prolong Iran's breakout capacity, which is absolutely great for a region that God knows needs more peace than, more conflict and war.
Mirzad Borujerdi, please stand by there. David Ignatius, what about, we have seen reports of delight in Tehran, but a good portion, I'm looking at a New York Times report here, where people are delighted with the idea that they may be headed back into the international community of nations. Now, I'm sure there's a whole range of response in Iran, but one of them is just, we don't want to be isolated. This is part of what Rouhani campaigned on, and now 100 days into his time as president, I guess is seen to be delivering.
Yes, I think you put your finger on the most important X factor here, which is the Iranian public. Sanctions have really harmed the Iranian economy. Iranians voted overwhelmingly for Rouhani. He got over 50% in a field of five candidates. From all of the reporting I've heard about that the U.S. and others did, that this shocked the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. So, in a sense, what we're seeing is a product of Iranian public demand that changes be made so that their economy doesn't crash. And I'm not surprised that there's a celebration in Tehran, because a country that wanted to move toward the West as opposed to only having allies in Russia and China has now done so. And that shouldn't upset us. Quite the opposite. Senator Corker should be glad that Iranians are happy about making a deal with the United States. How strange if we would think that was a terrible thing. I do think that what Emily Landau said from Israel is correct. The Iranians will dicker over every detail of this interim agreement. There'll be disagreements about what this provision means, that provision means. I mean, that's what negotiations are. I never saw a negotiation that didn't have that component. It's hard for me not to think that from the standpoint of Israel's security, even with the ambiguities in this agreement, it's not a better situation today than it was a week ago in terms of the limitations. The Iranians were rolling towards ever greater capability. Now that train is stopped, and if you read the language of the agreement, it appears in some limited respects to be reversed. But there will be disagreements aplenty. Again, that's what diplomatic negotiations are.
I want to look at that bilateral back channel that the U.S. and Iran had opened here, which apparently played a very large role. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday saying there was a lot of hype in the criticism of the deal. Kerry.
The president has made it clear he will not reduce or change the overall core architecture of the oil sanctions, banking sanctions. Iran will still be under enormous pressure precisely to complete the task. So I think there's a lot of hype and an awful lot of speculation about what is going on here.
Let's go to our listeners, see how they're taking it on board. Jason in Millbrook, Alabama. Jason, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you see?
Well, I've just got a few things here. Number one, I'm totally against this agreement, this diplomacy, as they call it. I do not believe that this is a situation where Iran has got the best interests of the Western states. Me personally, I think that it's more of a religiously thing, driven thing, as opposed to humanity on our side in the United States. I think we should listen more to Israel. They are closer to the situation. They understand the threats more so, I believe, than we do. And it really baffles me to think that, even for 6 months as an interim, agreement, that they can be trusted. And what I feel like is they're going to gain the trust and pacify us enough to where we're going to loosen and lessen some on these things that John Kerry has spoken about.
So even with the inspectors in there every day, Jason, you're not comforted?
No, even when the inspectors there every day. The thing is it's just there's a history there, going back on words, I mean, that's politics in itself anywhere around the world.
Jason, we've got it. There's definitely a history there. I mean, some looking now, I guess, to try and change or break that line of history. We hear your deep skepticism about it. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Afton, Virginia. Larry, you're on the air, Larry.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I am completely in favor of the deal. I am a Jewish American. And I believe that, in fact, when we talk about history, that there is ample history on both sides. If you want to go back to 53 and Mossadegh, or you want to go to 79 and the hostage crisis, both countries have their antagonisms and their histories. We need to give peace a chance. War is always out there. We have seen the American public's response to the idea of bombing in Syria and potential additional war in the Middle East. There's no enthusiasm for it here, and I don't support the apocalyptic right-wing cult that currently rules Israel and is trying to push us towards war.
Do you trust Iran, Larry? Do you trust Iran to follow through credibly with its promises?
I trust that Iran's economy is suffering under such great distress, and that the people of Iran, the people, maybe not some of their apocalyptic right-wing rulers as well, I don't know that I trust them all that much, but I trust the people of Iran want a reasonable life. They are currently suffering. They will continue to suffer under these sanctions as they are in place. We are not lifting much. We are very gently lifting our foot. We need to give peace a chance.
Larry in Afton, Virginia, we hear that loud and clear as well. We're going to come back and dive in to the details here, the dynamics. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the big deal with Iran, an interim deal over sanctions and its nuclear program, the controversy over the agreement, the possibilities here, the road ahead. Emily Landau joins us this hour from Tel Aviv in Israel, senior research fellow at Israel's Institute for National Security Studies. Mirzad Burujerdi is with us. He's director of the Middle East Studies program at Syracuse University. David Ignatius is with us, columnist for The Washington Post, covering foreign affairs, author of Blood Money. At his weekly cabinet meeting yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the negotiations again a historic mistake, saying the world is now in more danger than it was.
For the first time, the world's leading powers have agreed to uranium enrichment in Iran while ignoring the UN Security Council decisions that they themselves led. Sanctions have been given up in exchange for cosmetic Iranian concessions that can be reversed in weeks.
But in Geneva yesterday, British Foreign Secretary William Hague stood next to Secretary of State U.S. John Kerry and expressed support for the nuclear deal with Iran.
It is a good deal for the Middle East and for the world. It's a very important opportunity for the future, and I think it vindicates the policy of pressure through sanctions.
Lots of sanctions still on, some concern that those may erode. President Obama went before microphones just as soon as the deal was announced, called it an important first step.
In these negotiations, nothing will be agreed to unless everything is agreed to. The burden is on Iran to prove to the world that its nuclear program will be exclusively for peaceful purposes. If Iran seizes this opportunity, the Iranian people will benefit from rejoining the international community, and we can begin to chip away at the mistrust between our two nations.
The president, the instant the deal was announced, David Ignatius, Nixon to China brings back images of Henry Kissinger with his secret shuttle diplomacy. Now we learn there's been a big bilateral back channel in these negotiations. What has that looked like, and how important has it been, David?
The Kissingerian part of this, if you will, is the decision to conduct secret bilateral negotiations through Oman, which acted as the go-between. Secretary of State Kerry, in a sense, prepared the ground by visiting Oman last year before he became Secretary of State to do other business, but really to reinforce that channel. And then in March, before President Rouhani was elected, when the U.S. was wanting to make sure that the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei backed a negotiated solution, the first of these Oman-sponsored meetings took place. There were four additional ones subsequently, and they featured two fascinating characters, because they're often not in the spotlights. Mm. Deputy Secretary of State Bill Burns and White House Advisor Jacob Sullivan, who traveled to Oman, who did a lot of this discussion in secret, who traveled to Geneva when all the spotlights were on the Intercontinental Hotel where the foreign ministers were meeting. These two were in another hotel entirely, but increasingly, it seems, we're doing the real work. So it's a fascinating example of something that we know from history, which is that real diplomatic breakthroughs, real changes, really have to be done out of the spotlight, or they never get done. And in this case, Obama seems to have understood that and empowered his people to go forward.
Mirzad Borjerdi, how wide could that effort go if people pull up this parallel? And it could end up in a shambles and a failure, of course. But if there were progress on this front, not just the nuclear deal, but of the United States and Iran mending fences, making up after so many decades of severe alienation from one another. First of all, is that possible when Iran has its fingers in so many difficult pots in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria and right on Israel's borders in Lebanon and the West Bank? Is it possible the U.S. and Iran could fundamentally change this decades-long alienation? And what would the implications of that, what might they be for the region?
I think it's possible, but certainly there are many minefields in that path, considering the 30 years of hostility between the two states. The implications for a rapprochement between Iran and the U.S. could be immense. Iran, if it's persuaded as part of a larger, a nuclear agreement and reestablishment of ties or normalization of relations, if Iran can be convinced to help solve the conflict presently in Syria, where Iran and the U.S. actually do have a common interest, fighting the al-Qaeda type groups that seem to be mushrooming every day. Iran can be
helpful.
Well,
that's one interest, but the removal of Assad has been seen as an interest too. Iran has treated Syria as kind of an outpost on Syria's doorstep. Is it really willing to pull back from its influence there?
Well, look, I think everyone is coming to the conclusion that there is really no military solution when it comes to Syria. So if it's going to be solved diplomatically, certainly Iran as a major regional player, it has to have a seat at the table. I guess the analogy will be to the Lebanese civil war of the 1970s, where every regional power was involved. And it's too unrealistic to expect Iran will not be, you know, interested in what goes on in Syria. But it's also really besides Syria. I think, you know, right now, Afghanistan and Iraq, two countries where the U.S. has invested enormously over the last, you know, decade, are countries where the Iranians can play a more constructive role. The spillover effect from the Syrian conflict in a fragile country such as Lebanon can already be felt. Already one-fourth of Lebanon's population are being constituted of Syrian refugees. So, there is really a lot at the stake in terms of the region. But again, as was pointed out, this is going to be hard negotiations. There is going to be bickering. There is going to be finger pointing. And I don't think we should be discouraged by that. I mean, after all, we are not talking about, living happily ever after with one another, but learning to live with one another despite the differences, considering the significance of this region. Again, President Obama has been saying about his pivot to Asia, but that pivot to Asia has been torpedoed so far because of the problems in the Middle East. And you cannot address those problems in the region realistically and leave out one of the most important players. I think that's the lesson.
Emily Landau, in Israel, what do you think of the idea at this point of a rapprochement between the United States and Iran? Roger Cohen, writing today in the New York Times, that there's more than a tactical difference. There's kind of a strategic difference in the interest of the U.S. and Israel at this point. The U.S. Interested in a rapprochement and sees advantages in it. Israel seeing a diminishment of a kind of singular power in Israel's hands here if Iran and the United States make up. What are the implications of such a warming?
I think that the focus at this point needs to be on the nuclear issue. If a rapprochement comes after this issue is dealt with comprehensively, that's another issue, and actually Israel can benefit from that. If the nuclear issue is resolved and the United States and Iran get closer, I don't think this is something that would necessarily be a bad thing for Israel, because Iran could not be in better relations with the United States and continue with its horrific, horrific rhetoric towards Israel. Mm-hmm. We're hearing that Iran is so potentially constructive in the region. The Supreme Leader just called Israel mad, rabid dogs. He called Israel, and I'm sorry to have to use this language, but this is the language of the Supreme Leader of Iran, the bastard state. Okay, this is what we're hearing from Iran. Iran is a supporter of terror. Iran is, supporting Assad in Syria. So all of this is going on, and I don't think that we should just have this picture of Iran as, this potential a wonderful partner for the United States. It will be a long road. But let me say one thing about, the diplomacy on the nuclear issue. When I said that there will be continued bickering, obviously negotiating a new deal, there will be a lot of bickering. I'm talking about the bickering over the terms of the deal that they say they already have. If you make a deal, you can't continue to argue about every clause in that deal. That's what I'm afraid is going to happen, because it is Iran's tactic. Iran has not shown any indication that they're backing away from their military nuclear aspirations. There's nothing in the interim deal except for a mention of Parchin that will be dealt with in the comprehensive deal. There's nothing about the weaponization. The years of Iranian deception while they were working on a military nuclear program, all of that needs to come to light and be dealt with in the context of a comprehensive deal. The only comprehensive deal is one where Iran makes a U-turn on the nuclear front, backs away from its military ambitions. And for that to happen, the P5 plus one cannot give up the only leverage they have, which is the leverage that comes with the pressure of sanctions, before there is a comprehensive deal. If we talk about a historic change that's happened, the real historic change of the last negotiations between the P5 plus one and Iran is the fact that for the first time in 10 years, Iran is at the table because they need a deal as well, because they could not get sanctions lifted without cooperating with the international community. The international community needs to leverage that in order to get a comprehensive deal, which means, yes, dismantling most of Iran's nuclear program. Iran has been deceiving the international community, and it needs to make that U-turn.
Let me go to David calling from Boston. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Tom, when you began the hour, you mentioned, quoting others, I think, saying, is this a Nixon goes to China moment?
Mm.
And to me, that begs the question, is Mr. Obama similar to Nixon? And I'd have to say that Nixon was viewed as a arch-communist. So when he sat down...
Or arch-anti-communist.
Anti-communist.
Yep.
And I think we've seen strong deals come out when people who take strong positions do sit down. Menachem Begin sat down with Anwar Sadat and crafted a very durable peace agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, we had the Mike and Ed meetings of Mikhail Gorbachev. Ron meetings with Ron Reagan, who was also a staunch anti-communist. I think many people in the world, you know, view Obama, his last appearance in the Middle East, many people saw it as the apologizer-in-chief for the American president who came hat in hand to Cairo and was essentially kowtowing to dictators.
So may not come to this with the steel in his reputation that it would take. We take the point, David. It's a very interesting one. David Ignatius, what about it? This president trying this maneuver, a big maneuver here, and where he begins from now.
Well, since he came into office in 2009, President Obama has set as one of his goals publicly, but also in his secret diplomacy, a process of engagement with Iran. He sent two secret letters to the Ayatollah in 2009, signaling that he wanted a dialogue to reverse what is now 34 years of isolation. What's striking to me is that Obama, from very early in that first year, also began assembling the international coalition to adopt and enforce genuinely punishing sanctions against Iran. One way I've put it is he opened the door and then found a way to push Iran through that door towards the negotiation that culminated last weekend. And I think it's important to see, yes, the desire to the Nixon to China, desire to do the unconventional, but also the careful strategic assembly of the pressure mechanism that made a deal possible. I mean, that's the way you ought to do it. In truth, it wouldn't have happened otherwise. And we shouldn't forget that it was Obama who put together the sanctions coalition.
But once it's out there and in the open, as it is now, does he have the status? Does he have the posture to push it forward? I mean, we've seen within 24 hours plenty of pushback, including from plenty of people in his own party here. Is he positioned to push it on through, David?
Well, you sometimes get the feeling that Obama is just so weakened politically, he couldn't political credit for declaring an extra holiday.
Flag Day,
we'll see. I mean, I think just as failure breeds failure, there are increasing returns to failure, there are increasing returns to success. If this is perceived by commentators as generally a successful negotiation, that certainly is the way I would characterize it. I think over time he may tend to get some credit for that, but we'll see. This I mean, what I've seen in this process is that, you know, again, reinforces that Obama is most effective in secret. This was a secret bilateral negotiation. Our covert commander-in-chief authorized it. The public part of the job still seems very difficult for him.
Mirzad Berzerdi, do you think that the hardliners in Iran are willing to settle for no bomb, no nuclear weaponry?
I think the way things are going right now, there is a poverty of options for them as well. What this nuclear deal does is that it improves dramatically the standing of President Rouhani and other moderates in Iran. He managed to deliver on this thing. Actually, today is, you know, the 100th day that he has been in office. And, he has the blessing of the supreme leader. But I think, you know, we also need to keep the following points in mind. There is a limit to what sanctions can do. Iran has been subjected to sanctions for three decades. But again, this is a big country with a diverse economy. Mm-hmm. You know, nine other neighboring countries with which it has borders. You have China not willing to further cut back on oil purchases from Iran. The sanctions in EU courts are being questioned, etc. So there is a limit to what sanctions can do. And I think the Iranians also realize that.
I'm afraid we're out of time right there, but I'm sorry we can't get to it all. There's a lot on the plate right now, and we hope to have you back to hear more as this all rolls forward. All three of you would be great. I want to thank you for joining us today. Mirzad Burujerdi at the Syracuse University Middle East Studies Program. Thank you very much for being here, Mirzad.
Thank you.
Emily Landau in Tel Aviv at the Institute for National Security Studies in Israel. Thank you for joining us, Emily.
Thank you.
And David Ignatius at the Washington Post. Thank you as always, David.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.